My name is Clyde, and I'm an addict. And I'm blessed to be born with this addiction. When they asked me to speak, I was just overwhelmed because, like, it's just an honor to someone to see that you're doing something that might be beneficial to someone else. My clean date is June 16, 1981. Since that date, the opportunity and the compulsion hasn't shown up at the same time. I was born in Alexandria, Virginia, and I'm glad I got people up front here to keep me honest. They know me, you know. And I was the third oldest of seven kids. Addiction ran on both sides of my family. The most natural thing for me to do was to use. I remember when I was about 3 years old, I used to open beers for my father. He sent me, go get me a beer, boy. And it was an art to it because they didn't have flip top. You used to have a beer opener. You have to press it on one side, a little hole there, so the phone went, then open it on the other side. So when the phone came out, I'd drink it. And I'd take it to him. And one time I took it to him, he looked over at my mother and said, "Addie, the boy done drunk the whole beer." and my mother said, "That's all right. Let him drink it now. When he get older, he won't like it." And I went through that whole era. I went through an era where in the neighborhood I grew up doing segregation. I gave my clean date. Now I'm gonna give my birth date. My birthday is October 24th, 1944. So in October I'd be 68. And so what happened was, in my area where I grew up, we used to have to cut wood, and had coal to bank the fires, and all the blacks in the neighborhood were like kin. You know, like we had cousins over here. It was segregation, so it was, you know, like, and we had a banker over here, a mortician over here, a street cleaner. All of us was in the same community. And all the blacks, mostly in my community, did service work, like domestic, garden, whatever it is. And all the whites in the neighborhood were up like middle class and upper middle class. So I grew up playing with whites, but when it was time to go to school, was bus to school. And as I said, I used to have to cut, and it was three families. I have my family, my aunts, and their kids all in the same house. And when I was about 12 years old, my aunt moved out. She moved into some government subsidized housing. In Alexandria, they call them projects. I don't know what they call them. we went to visit her. It was around January. It was real cold out. We went to visit my aunt, and she said, "Oh," she said, "the place is a little cold." So she went to the wall, and I didn't know what that thing was then, but I found out it was a thermostat. And she changed it, and the house got all warm. I didn't see anybody shoveling coal. I didn't see nobody cutting wood. I didn't see nobody taking no ashes out. So I moved with my aunt. and you know, the things changed when I moved with my aunt. Things changed. Where I lived, that we didn't have a key to our house. I never knew anything about a key. I didn't know what to do with a key. When I moved there, she said, "All right, these are two keys." She said, "This key right here is for this lock." She said, "You might forget that, but make sure you lock this one." That was a deadbolt. So I was learning new rules. She said, "And before it gets dark, I want you to bring the clothes in off the line." She said, "Matter of fact, bring the line in too." So rules started changing. And the guys I started hanging with started changing. I played basketball in my neighborhood, and I was pretty good. I was pretty good, and people would gravitate to me because I was pretty good. And where I moved at, we won the city championship, you know, in the summer, and I started hanging with guys. I started drinking, and they first thing they said, "Boy, that young boy can handle his liquor," because right away I could drink a lot. and when you can start drinking a lot, nobody wants you to put in with them no more. You know, I couldn't put my money in with them. No, that's all right. You know? So, and then I learned other things. You know, I learned how to tuck and roll. I learned how to creep in buildings. I learned how to note. I learned how to count. You know, I learned all the confidence game because they had a saying in my town. In Alexandria, they say, "What beats game?" And they say, "Mo better game, my man." So I had that, and I had basketball. When I came out of high school, I didn't go to college. You know, I didn't go to college. I went into the service because during that time they were drafting people, and I wanted to make a choice of my own. So I went into the Air Force, and when I went into the service, they had special services in there. You know, they had a thing called special services, like because they were drafting pros and college graduates, and they on the basketball teams there, they were in the special services. They didn't. That was their job in the service, was playing basketball. So I was 17 years old, and I was in special services. And then I learned, and I was gravitated to guys who were just like me. You know, I learned how to drink there. You know what I mean? I learned how to drink gin and tonic in the summer. Around September to October, we changed over to a little dark liquor, you know, like scotch or rum. And during, around Christmas time, around winter time, we changed to cognac. By the time I got out of the service, it seemed like Wild Irish Rose fit every season. And then I started adding things. You know, a guy asked me, say, "Clyde, have you ever smoked marijuana?" Immediately I told him, I lied two times. I said, "Well, I'm from D.C. And I say, "Everybody in D.C. smokes." And then I learned how to smoke. And I never stopped doing anything. I started adding. I added that to what I was doing. And I went through the service. But when I got out of the service, I was 21 years old with a wife that was 17 and pregnant and another lady who was pregnant. So what I did, my plan was, because when I came out, I'd been offered a scholarship to San Diego State. I said, "I'm going to come home to D.C. area, take my wife over to my mother, and go to California." Well, when I got there, I pulled in with my wife, and the other lady who was pregnant, she moved into this town with us too, but she moved all the way on the island in D.C., you know, southeast. and so when I got here, my friends, we was talking about one of them today, Joel C., and all of them came to pick me up at the bus station was down at 12th and New York Avenue then. They came to pick me up, and they came in a deuce and a quarter. You know, when I went into the service, they were winding windows down. When I came in, they were pushing. When I came back, they were pushing buttons. They pushed a button, and the window went down, and they came to pick me up. They gave me a ball, gave me a $100 bill, and told me, "Go get something from the store." I went and got it. I came back, tried to give them some change. They said, "Oh, come on, keep it." So the first thing I asked, I said, "What are y'all doing?" So they were hustling. During that time, during the early 60s, when I got out in 66, during that time, people didn't have to apply for charge cards. They would mail them to you. And they were working at the post office. So they were working the charge cards. So I got in with them. I started working charge cards with them. And the strange thing happened. They sent me my charge card, and I started working that like I was working the rest of them. And I got in a lot of debt. And by that time, I was working up on Capitol Hill at the Library of Congress. I got in a lot of debt. And a guy, because I could kick it, you know, I kicked the bobo. And the guy said, man, have you ever, he said, I know how you can make some money. Have you ever messed with heroin? I told him, well, when the service, that's all I messed with her. Of course I messed with heroin. He gave me some drugs, and I didn't know what to do with it. So I called the guys who I was hustling credit cards with. I told them, man, this guy gave me some dope, and I don't know what to do with it. They said, we'll be right over. We are going to show you how to move these drugs. All right, so they came over, and they were doing buck actions then, so we was putting the cut, and I give them a package, and they come back and say, you know, my wife found it and flushed it down the toilet. They say the police came, I had to throw it away. They were really showing me how to move this stuff, you know. And then I was doing it, and I seen one of them snort something. I didn't know how it made them feel, but I know how it made them look. So I put them all out my apartment, and I tried some of it. I said, boy, this is what I've been looking for all my life. I said, I can't imagine nobody not wanting any of this. And I immediately became my best customer. Not only I owed every Jew and Gentile, I owed these brothers now, and they had a different collection agent. You know, they had baseball bats. You know, so I they couldn't answer the door and stuff like that, you know. And then after I used enough, it didn't matter. You know, the fear factor left. So I went through this whole thing, and then and about 1970, I flipped out on some angel dust. I flipped out, and I thought I was Jesus. You know, I got in my car, and I was driving up, and I drove to the turnpike at Baltimore. You know, Baltimore Turnpike, and they asked me to pay them, and I told them to bill me. And then I told my friends I was going up to the United Nations and make a change. You know, I got down here a little further, and I stopped at the next toll, and they arrested me. They took me to jail, and my folks was looking for me, you know, because it was during that time when they were, you know, riding and all that stuff. I had Big Bush and all that kind of stuff. I looked like Rap Brown, you know, and you know that was a long time ago, you know. My sisters and them came to get me out of the jail. They say, we want my brother. They say, you can have him. They say, tell Casey, come on out. So I started walking out, and my sisters looked at me and said, go back. I was buck naked. You know, by that time, you know I'd have moved from my mother's name. I'm staying with my parents now. My mother said, don't bring them here. So they took me to the VA hospital. And when I got over to the VA hospital, they gave me some Thorazine. And then they told me what happened to the last Jesus. So that sort of brought me back around. And I'm going to tell you something. I ain't like Thorazine. You know, and when I got out of there, my wife and I really separated, because she told me, she said, this is it. She said, you got to make a decision. She says, either me and the kids are those drugs. So I call my friend and say, come on, help me pack. She done gone crazy. She done gone crazy. She ain't never make me feel like that. So I moved. You know, I moved over Marlboro Plaza. You know, during the time, I mean, that was the joint. I moved up on the 10th floor. The carpet was so thick, you had to put the door up to open. And I go out and you look on the balcony, you can see planes taking off at Bowling. And if you get out there and look like this, you can see RFK Stadium. I had a Lincoln Town Car. I ride through town, people holler at me, I wave out the sunroof at them, you know. After a while, that Lincoln Town Car turned into a Chevrolet. That Chevrolet turned into some Converse sneakers. And that wonderful view ended up in my parents' basement. The only thing between me and homelessness was my parents. All right, and 1980. See, I missed the whole 70s. I was the oldest known teenager in D.C. In 1980, a friend of mine in the oil joint. You know, it's a strange thing about an oil joint. I had to my parents' place to go to, you know what I mean? And I go into the oil joint where the toilets, you know, ain't got no plumbing. Because somebody made that their place, you know? And it's stinking in there. I go, ooh. Once I get a hit, though, I can sit there and talk all night. So we went, a guy told me, he looked over at me and I was looking so bad that he said, man, you could probably get some help. You know, you need to get some help. And so he told me about the VA hospital. I said, oh, I'm already on that. I'm already on the methadone program. You know, that's the welfare dope. You know, I was already on that. You know. So I'm going to get with Network. You know what I mean? The guy told me that. So I said, well, let me go up and see. I went up there. It was June 16th, 1980. I went to the VA hospital. That's where I met my sponsor, Charles, at. When I got there, he'll tell you right now, he said I was the worst one they ever seen before or after. I came in there weighing about a 130. I had more tracks than a railroad. You know, I had tracks on my knees, feet, and I was shaking. I was talking in parables. I'd say three or four words and start laughing, thinking you knew the rest of it. and I was shaking so much, I told Charles, I said, man, they said they might get me clean. They'll never stop me from shaking, though. But he told me, man, they're going to stop you from shaking, too. And I met this lady up there named Carmelita W. Carmelita told me, she said, boy, you're going to help a lot of people. And see, I just came from the streets where I was doing so bad, people. You know, my ability to help and my ability to dream had died. And someone told me that, so I held on to that. So, and they taught me, they taught us some things up there, too. They taught us about we had to parrot the 12 steps, to parrot it so we can go out on passes to meetings and stuff. So we could parrot, you know, like we do. You know how y'all do. And the meetings, how we do it, you know, I would say it, then everybody parrot it. But if we don't incorporate it, we're just parrots. And you know what parrots are? Parrots are in cages. So we have to incorporate those steps into our lives. I didn't learn that till after a while. And I went there, and they said it was there for 90 days. They said 90-day treatment. They kept me there 7. And I went in June 16th and got out January the 7th. Of 1981, my brothers came to pick me up, and before I was off the grounds, I was using again. He said, this is some stuff from over Panama's Red or something. He said, I said, well, yeah. He was saying, well, yeah, yeah, yeah. So, and then I was right back using. So I went back. Because I was back using. I was back up on the strip. And I went back to the VA, and I tried to get back in. I said, I need to get back in. They said, why? I said, I'm using. They say, you ain't been out but a week. They say, use the tools that you have. So Charles had moved into an Oxford house. So he called me, told me, come on over to this Oxford house. So I said, okay. Because I had never knew the difference before, because I had always used. I couldn't compare it with anything. That time, without using, I could compare it with something now. I could start, it helped me to start praying again. Start, you know, feeling good. And so he told me to come over there. So I moved to the Oxford House. I was like 36 years old when I ran away from home. I got over there. And you know, and what happened was, the blessing was, N.A. was real new at D.C. So I started coming to meetings. We come to meetings, and during that time, you have to sign in at meetings. And if you go back and look at those sign-in sheets, it'd either be Charles's name first or my name first, you know, first or second. And I came to enough meetings where it made more sense to stay clean than it did to get high. The steps were very, you know, I did the first three steps. And because we didn't have a lot of step meetings. Matter of fact, we used to have the other people from other fellowships would come in and help us out with step meetings when we started. But we was about four or five years clean then. When I was in 1983, I went to my first convention. It was the World Convention in New York City. And Jimmy Kay, the founder of the program, he was the speaker there. I saw about 1,300 addicts there. If you asked me when I came back, I told you it was 13,000. You know, and I saw people from all over the world, you know, from different parts, like here, people from all over the country coming, and I said, wow. And now the next year, I started going to conventions. Next year was in Chicago, and we were doing marvelous things here because at 90 days, I was a GSR, I was chairperson of a group, and stuff. And I remember when I got 1 year clean. I got 1 year clean, and I think that's when I dropped the rock because I told my mother, I said, Mom, I know you're proud of me. She said, why? I said, Mama, I got 1 year clean from drugs. She said, hell, I ain't tell you used them in the first place. So right then I realized that it wasn't important for her. It was important for me. And then during that time, I started speaking at conventions. You know, I spoke at a convention in Boca Raton, Bahamas. I mean, I got 3 years clean. I marvelous things. I checked with my wife because I had to. I thought she was still my wife, you know, because I was still doing some drive-bys, and, you know. We were still on that honey tip. Honey, how you doing, honey? And I went over and I had to put in for, because I got a job. You know, I started working then and I had to get a clearance. So I called, I said, well, that was in 81, you know, I'm working it up. I said, what's our status? Like, I put it, are we married or something? She said, oh, hell, I divorced you in 76. And she didn't even tell me. And so I came in to serve. I came in here, and after that, I got clean, and I got married again. You know, we came in here, got married. I went back to school, got me a master's degree of clinical therapist because I wanted to work in the field. I wanted to do that. And we got the house, the car, the dogs. And then after I graduated, they asked me, they called me, and they wanted me to do something at the World Convention. They said, we want you to work. We want you to, they called me around January. They said, I want you to do a workshop at the World Convention. I said to myself, well, you know, it's about time. Ego all out there, you know. Hey, and then they said, that was in 88. They say it's on the fourth and fifth step. I say, oh, okay, I'll do it. I say, must be time to do it then. I'm going to tell you, the steps came involved. I do the first step. It was no problem with the first step. The first step just demonstrated the problem. And the second step is the solution. See, it was a hard thing for us, the solution, because, see, when I was 3 years old, I went across the street and a car hit me. You understand? Knocked me up and down. And my parents said the car ran over my head. They said, and every time I'd act strange, they'd hit himself. He said, you know, the car ran over his head. So coming, restoring me to sanity, that was a hard thing. Because I was using craziness to justify everything. So I came to believe that a power greater than myself, and I really was trusting. I was trusting Charles and the rest of the guys who came out of treatment with me. I was trusting them because I always thought that if they could do it, I could do it. So I started following them, and then the third step. So I made a decision. I made a decision to use this power greater than myself, the power I call God for me. And what I loved about it was the God that I chose. See, because the God that I had from a kid, that fire and brimstone God, where them preachers get up there and talk that stuff, when I was 6 years old, I did enough that I know God couldn't. I'd already did enough not to go to that place they was talking about. So I had to come in here and I had to get a God of my understanding. And then, as I say, when I had that fourth step, I had about 7 years before I did my fourth step. And what happened was I was preparing for it because when I got to school, when I went back to school, I had to learn how to prioritize my life. And so they told me in January, and I didn't have to do the workshop until September. So by that time, I had an opportunity. I made it important. I set aside an hour each day for a fourth step. Even if I didn't write nothing down, I'd set that. That was a fourth step time. After a while, the hour became a couple of hours. Then I made an appointment to do my fifth step. See, in the fourth step, what I found out about me was a lot of my role models' values and my behavior never matched. So I had to find something that I would live and die for. I had to find something that fit me. And I had to find what I had to find. I had to find out the truth about me. And then I did a fifth step with all of the relationships I destroyed. I restored a relationship with me, and God I destroyed a relationship with, and society. So we all was present. And what we did, we improved on the truth I learned in the fourth step. And then I didn't procrastinate on the sixth and seventh step, because when I went out and did that fourth step, when I came back, the lady who I was married to at the time, she didn't feel married. She wanted a marriage, but she wanted an open marriage, you know. And so I wasn't feeling that. So we were talking about divorce, and all my character defects came out then. You know, because NA is a small community, especially in D.C. area, and so she was having, you know, with people in the fellowship, and people were coming back and saying, you know, Clyde, I thought they were my friend. They said, you know, Clyde, I saw her with so-and-so. Did you know she was with so-and-so? And see, things started changing for me, you know what I mean? I started, behaviors came out like stalking. Character assassination. Baseball bat back in the car. Chasing people down the street with the baseball bat. So I talked to my sponsor, and he told me, you know, we pray and get ready. I wanted anybody to remove those defects from character. You know, so he said, you pray and God removes them. So I prayed, and I believe this. I believe we pray like everything depends on God, and we work like everything depends on us. I did some work. I went outside. I went to therapy. I did things like it. I'm not saying that that's what you need. I'm talking about my story. So I did that, and I found out some things about me. And so I started working on me. You know, I started working on me. I started doing things that I thought would help me. I started keeping time with me. I moved. I got me a place. And I started keeping appointments with me. See, I had to learn how to treat me. So I started taking me out on dates. And somebody asked me to come do something. I said, no, I got a previous appointment. I started praying and meditating. I was going to get massages, pedicures, and manicure. I stay fresh now, you know. facials. I had to learn how to treat me so I could treat somebody else. So then I made the list for the men. And then I made the men. See, the men's, it's not valid. A men's is not valid until there's a behavior change. Mm. See, it was a behavior change from that fourth and fifth step to the ninth step. You know, and I did some changes, and I was working on me, and then they asked me to speak again at the World Convention. In 1992, I was the opening speaker at the World Convention in Toronto. And the blessing is, it gave me opportunity to get some help from other people. See that when you get up here and get this mic, sometimes your head can get big. So I had to step away because I knew that somebody else got a better story than me. I know that somebody else has a better message than me. They just haven't put that pipe down yet and came in. You know, I understand that. And I've been around all over this program. I've been to all over the place speaking. I've met people in here. I've met people who we went. I went to their house. They put me there, and they had valets driving. I went to people's, and I went to Newark when we had the World. See, we had the World Convention here in 1985, and I was the fundraising chairman. So I went all out, and we. I'm gonna tell you what we did here in D.C. And when I told you about it, we went to convention in '83. When they went to the next convention, they supposed to pass seed money. The next convention was in Chicago. They passed them some T-shirts. They ain't make no money. We went to Chicago and we went there to convention. We got the bid for the 85. When we got the bid, you know what they passed on us? Some T-shirts. We said we wanted it because we wanted to say, you know, we were predominantly black here. And we wanted, in every convention we went to during that time, mostly were, you know, Eurocentric. Because we see it lures, because we started not having the money to afford it, or we just didn't know. So when we had the convention here, when we finished, we had $85,000 to pass on to the world. A lot of the things that they're using now in conventions that they started, we started here in D.C. That's why I was alarmed, not alarmed, but just seeing that crowd in front of the for registration. We had it hooked up so you could come in, and we wasn't a crowd. You know, we had it hooked up with computers to just come in here and do different things. That was back in '85. So we did it so well that the person that was working on our committee, they hired him at the world, and he's the one that sets up conventions all over now for them ever since that time. So we do a lot of wonderful things, and this program, so I started working on myself and I started doing things. And then, lo and behold, I went to this party. You know, I'm still at now. I'm doing the 10th step now constantly because I work in the field. I'm working with other, I'm working counseling. And if I can't help nobody, I'm not trying not to hurt them. So I'm doing a constant inventory. And then I'm inventorying with other therapists there also to see if everything going on. Is this my stuff? You know. And then And then the 11th step, you know, I love to pray. So through prayer and meditation, I keep my appointments with God. See, I keep my appointments with God. I keep my appointments with the prayer and meditation because prayer works. See, people prayed me in here. And all wasn't nobody, that didn't necessarily have to be some friends of mine. They prayed, he said, he better go in there and get some help before I kill him. That's a prayer. You know, people prayed me in here. And I prayed, and I've seen prayer work. Now, the people who don't believe in prayer, y'all must never needed one. And after coming here, and then the pass the message, it's just an honor and a privilege to pass the message. And I can get the message also, because the person who got one day in here got something to tell me. You understand? And then after I stayed here for a while and I worked on myself after the divorce and, you know, I went to a party, anniversary party. I was at the time where I wasn't staying past 12 o'clock. Because, you know, that's when we started choosing at 12, you know. And I was trying to work on me a little more. And I ran into the woman who's my wife now. You know, I started dating her, you know, and we did it the old-fashioned way, you know what I mean? We dated, you know what I mean? We stayed, you know, we didn't rush to intimacy, you know what I mean? We did it the old-fashioned way, and that was pretty hard for me because I'd gotten work on. I had to move to go to bed the first night. I had that move, you know. So it was, I worked on that move. I was good at that move. So I wanted something different, though. See, I was good at that move. I didn't like the results that I was getting. You know, so we dated, and then for a year, then we got engaged. And then we got married. And we went to Paris for our honeymoon. Yeah, I wanted to see how that Mona Lisa paled next to her. I would tell you, this wife of mine, I love her so much. I really do, that I could sit on the push and watch grass grow with her. You know, you get in here, we get clean, and you know you can start, look over beside you, And it's your soulmate laying there. You know, not your cellmate. Yeah, things change in here. And it's changed for me. And so what happened when we got married? She don't like me to tell you this, but I'm gonna go ahead and say that. We got married and our credit was so bad. And some places they wouldn't even accept cash, you know. and so she was I was a counselor. And before that, you know, with my friends, right, I filed bankruptcy, you know what I mean? And I was real new. And we prayed and we went and looked for a house and got a house. And I'm going to tell you, the house was much better than the house I lost last time. You understand what I'm saying? House was much better. And then we was there for about a year, and she came back and told me, she said, I feel called to the ministry. I said, well, okay. got called, huh? And she said, but I can go to school, I can go part-time. And I said, you know, I don't think God calls us part-time. So I said, we're gonna do is, you're going to go ahead to school, and we're going to see how it works out. We had just got two new cars, you know, a house. And I said to myself, she said, well, how are we going to, I said, well, if God calls, if he takes the house, I said, shoot, next house probably be in Great Falls somewhere, the way God's evidence I got. So we went there, and she went to school. We kept the house. We kept the cars, and she went on and became minister. Now she pastors the church. Went back, got a doctorate degree in it. She did all that for her and her God. Mm-hmm. See, but when I first met her, I said, if I can't accept her just the way she is, mm-hmm. I'm rolling out. Because you know all the relationships we get in and say, yeah, we can work on this. Mm-hmm. No, I can't work on nothing. I can't work on me without some help and being willing to. So we did that, and we're doing marvelous things. And since that time, I've gone back to school, and I got my Master's of Divinity. I'm associate pastor right there. And I come to let you know that, you know, that's my story now. God can do most marvelous things. God can take a crooked stick and make a straight lift. You know. I see people in here, and I understand, see, and I look at people, especially when I'm counseling them, and I look at them, and they say, they come in there looking real bad, like that. I say, oh, man, you can make it. Because I have never counseled anyone who looked as bad as I was. I never seen no one look back that was doing as bad as me. If God can do it for me, my. And we got people in here that's, it's a pleasure to pass the message. Sometimes the only basic text somebody might see is us. You know, we get caught up in these rooms. The rooms is not where the work starts. The work starts outside the room. It's what we do with when we get the information. And this living is, you know, living is easy.
Yes, it is.
Come on now. Hey, for complicated people like us. They told me when I first came in here, they say an addict can take a tree and turn it into a forest and then immediately get lost in it. This is the best thing. You know, a lot of people, and then when I went there, I came to get the understanding with God through the 12 steps. The 12 steps gave me a relationship. See, between 3, when we make that decision, and 11, when we start to improve our conscious contact, there's some work to be done. See, we don't hear from it until we get to that 11. There's some work to be done. And see, when I was around here at first doing the 12, you know, doing the meetings, I was probably delivering the message, not the message. Because, see, in this program, all we get out of here from other people is their opinion. The steps is the process of the program. The steps don't lie. We work the steps, and I'm going to tell you, I've seen people in here who work just the first step. And they stay clean. I don't know if it works for them. I've seen people who come in here and work all 12 and go back out. So I don't know what it is. I know one thing, though. The quality of my life changed after I worked the 12 step. If you want to, they say you can live in a hut or a castle. It's all, and I don't think it's talking about a hut, castle, or as a building or something. Like I'm talking about inside, up here, inside of us. You understand? And it's I get up in the morning, and I, you know what? I like me. You know, I get up there, and after working the steps and working, I get in there, and I'm so glad to be me. As a matter of fact, I'm tickled pink. So this program would afford you to live the most marvelous dreams. You can live your dreams in here. You know, some people tell you, you know, and we get the opportunity to say, like fear. I'm going to tell you about something. I'm going to tell you about fear. I come through here, I have a problem with that Bay Bridge. No, I have a problem crossing that Bay Bridge. Right? But I'm going to tell you what happened. October passed October, I was I had a major operation. They found cancer on my liver. It's because I wouldn't have had the cancer if I hadn't had hepatitis. You know what I mean? When I told somebody to leave me a little something in the cooker, I ain't tell them to leave me the hepatitis, but they did. You know, so it was God that gave me the opportunity to say they removed the cancer. I am cancer free now. I'm gonna tell you something else too. I had to take off, and because I was going back and forth to school, I was working full time and going to school, so I was using summer leave. I didn't have any leave. Matter of fact, I didn't even have enough leave to go from D.C. to Maryland. But people started donating leave to me. That's the glory of this program that introduced me to a God that can do anything but fail. People started donating leave to me. I tried to go back to work January 1st. My supervisor said, oh, no, you got too much leave to come back. The people who gave you that leave would lose it. So I said, okay, I'll come back April 1st. So I went in there April. They say, come back the 30th. I'm going to tell you how God works this thing out. Hey, come back April the 30th. And we find out in here, too, it's not about us. Because I see people here that's with the council, with whatever. There are a lot of people here who are better off. But there's no one better than. Everyone, I have never seen anyone come in here and stay clean and do bad. Even if you come in here and get clean and don't have a job, you done gave yourself a pay raise. We get an opportunity to see that this works for me. I dare you to try. Hey, what that did for me was keep coming back. I heard, you know, we heard in the meetings where when people go back out, they ask them, they say, why you go back out? They never say, I stopped talking to my sponsor. They never say, I stopped praying. All I hear is, I stopped going to meetings. Meeting makers make it. How much time, brother? 10 minutes. You know, the thing they told me when I first came here, I could talk for 2 hours. Hey, by the time I finish, you know how to cop. Hey, which size needle to use? You know, and the thing is, though, the blessing in here is we get an opportunity I come in here and I'm not looking for the good dope now. I'm looking for the good sense. You know, I will go regress a little bit. I talk about my sponsor, what he told me about my brother. Me and my sponsor moved together. He thought I had more time than I had. You know, it was during the time when we didn't even have the basic text in D.C. area. Somebody came through with the white book. And you know we took in Xerox. You know, so they would give chips out, 90-day chips. And, you know, 1 month, 90 days, 30 days. So between that 1 month here and that 90-day here, I was in a meeting, and somebody said, you know, they got some of that 757 down there on the corner that's killing people. I eased out the meeting. it took me a year to get back to get clean. My clean day, I told you I went to treatment on June 16th, 1980. My clean date is June 16th, 1981. And And so we moved together, and I had a job. All I could afford with this job was a flash pass, and I started being a little more productive, and I was giving my previous kids, my previous wife, some money for the kids. And I gave them money, and then, you know, and my kids would come back, my son come back and say, "Daddy, you know, I know you gave the money, because Mom, she's doing it." I was fortunate enough to have fantastic mothers for the children I had. They were fantastic mothers. So he'd come back and say, "You know, Daddy, you do it, but I want some, you know, I want some Mad Jordan." So I go back to my sponsor. I told Charles, I said, "Charles, I'm in a dilemma here." I say, when I give them the money for the different things, I feel bad because I'm back like I'm feeling dope because I had to borrow money to go to work and all that kind of stuff. And I say, when I don't give him the money, I feel bad. Charles say, "Well, if you go feel bad with your money." And what that afforded me to do, though, was to tell my son my story, how I got in this position to be like that. And the blessing is, at this point, he's not using, to my understanding. Because I let him know the marvelous things you can do when you don't. Well, I really appreciate this y'all being here, because if it wasn't for you, there would be no me. I know my recovery depends on the NA Fellowship. I know that. I've never doubted that. I told you what I do, my professional church, but I still go to meetings. I still have a home group. And I still have a sponsor. My mother, one thing that happens when we get older in here, we start losing people. You know, like my mother, my father, they're gone, but they had the opportunity to see me clean. I don't know if they have the opportunity to see other things. They have an opportunity to see me clean. I have my relationships with my siblings. It's not all that it could be, but I have forgiven them. You know, I've forgiven them, and I'm working on, and I ask for forgiveness from them for things. And that's all them, whatever they do. If I did my part. I just want to thank y'all once again for allowing me to come here to share a message, and I'm hoping that it was a message of hope. Thank you.